All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.
On October 16, 1992, one of the greatest horror films of the 1990s, Candyman, opened across the country. Filmed on location in Chicago, the film told the story of a grad student named Helen Lyle, played by Virginia Madsen, who learns of an urban legend about the murdered son of a slave with a hook for a hand who preys on the residents of a notorious housing project in the city. And he could be summoned by looking in a mirror and calling his name five times. Helen's research turns up a chilling number of identical murders in the neighborhood, and she decides to visit the housing project with her friend, Bernadette. She believes the so-called Candyman, this urban legend, is a real killer who uses the neighborhood boogeyman to create fear among the residents of the projects. Laughing at the silly legend, Helen proves to her friend it's not true by looking into a mirror and summoning Candyman, with, of course, bloody and terrifying results. Now, this is one of my favorite horror films, and it was made even more chilling back in the 90s because it was filmed on location at the now-vanished Cabrini Green housing project in Chicago, a place I was pretty familiar with. But it's the reality that inspired the film, the racial terror, the poverty, the drugs, the police indifference, and the disturbing murder of a Chicago woman that becomes even more frightening than the movie itself. Welcome to American Hauntings, the podcast dedicated to the history, hauntings, legends, lore, and the dark side of American history. And welcome to the latest episode of Season 9, which we call Based on a True Story. American Hauntings is written and performed by Troy Taylor, that's me, and is produced and co-hosted by Cody Beck. And this season, the two of us will be handing out the tickets, directing you to your seat, and telling you to turn off your phone and zip your lips because the feature presentation is about to begin. And when those projectors fire up, we'll be introducing you to not only real-life stories of ghosts, demons, hauntings, crime, and murder, but also the terrifying films that were inspired by them. If you get too scared, you can try telling yourself, it's only a movie. But that's not really going to work. Each episode will present a film that's not only horrifying, but is based on a true story in which the real-life events are much scarier than anything a director, cast, and crew can put onto a movie screen. This is Episode 4 of Season 9, Candyman. 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 Yeah, not a chance. At around 9:45 p.m. on the night of April 22, 1987, the Chicago police received a 911 call from a woman named Ruthie Mae McCoy, who was not a resident of Cabrini Green, but the Grace Abbott Homes, another example of horrific Chicago public housing projects at the time. In 1987, the seven Y-shaped 15-story Grace Abbott Towers were home to about 3,600 African-American men, women, and mostly children, most being raised by single mothers, aunts, and grandmothers. Members of a faction of the gangster disciples called the Paymasters roamed the halls selling drugs. Robbery and violence were common, and most Abbott residents were doing anything they needed to in order to survive. Murders were all too frequent, but would be the murder of Ruthie Mae McCoy that would draw attention to Abbott and the other housing projects in the city. And of course, inspire a frightening film that still wasn't as scary as the conditions that so many poor black residents of Chicago were then living under. Ruthie Mae was born in Hughes, Arkansas in 1935, one of eight children. When she was very young, her family, like numerous other Southern black families, moved to Chicago's industrial South Side, looking for a better life. But the promise of the big city proved to be better than reality. Ruthie Mae's father was able to find a job, but loading coal onto wagons in various yards, earning a low wage, but still allowing the large family to barely scrape by. As the prayer card handed out at her funeral later stated, quote, "Ruthie had a hard life." She attended school, but never did well. She made it through just 1 year of high school. Then, signs of mental illness began appearing when she was in her early 20s. No one knew the exact nature of her illness, but recalled times when she talked to herself and would burst unexpectedly into anger, shouting and screaming. Ruthie Mae never married. She was 27 when her only child, Vernita, was born at Cook County Hospital. The father didn't stick around for long, leaving Ruthie Mae forever bitter with men in general. Vernita often had to stay with relatives as a child because her mother was placed in institutions on several occasions. When she was taking her medication, Ruthie Mae managed well, but when she didn't, she was unpredictable and sometimes violent. And at 250 pounds and nearly 6 feet tall, she was an intimidating figure. Ruthie Mae worked at many low-paying jobs, like laundromat attendant and housekeeper, but her mental issues kept her from holding a job for longer than a month or two. And because of this, she spent most of her adult life on public aid. When Vernita was a baby, she and her mother lived in the Dearborn Homes, a Southside housing project, and then in a series of cramped, rundown apartments on the south and west sides. In 1983, while Vernita was in the Cook County Jail for a short time, Ruthie Mae took care of her one-year-old, and he was still with her when her apartment flooded. And Ruthie Mae applied for an emergency spot with the Chicago Housing Authority. She asked in a letter to the CHA to be placed in Wentworth Gardens on the south side and near her relatives, or at least not in a high-rise building. Unfortunately, few apartments were available, and she was offered an 11th floor unit in the Abbott Homes, exactly where she didn't want to be. But in May 1983, she moved into apartment 1109. The place that Ruthie was offered by the CHA simmered with violence. Children were raised in the chaos and simply became used to it. All residents of the Abbott Homes were black, and most were under 18. Except for some of the drug dealers, everyone was poor. Residents of Abbott were beaten, raped, and murdered more than twice as often as residents of the rest of the city. Even by public housing standards, the place was bad news. It had been built in a way that attracted crime. Studies showed that crime rates increased with the height of the buildings, and blocks of high-rises like the Abbott Homes were, in terms of crime, the worst possible for public housing. In a 1978 book that was written about Chicago's public housing projects, author Devereaux Boley Jr. wrote, "More than any project built in Chicago to date, the overall feeling of Abbott Homes is forbidding. And the human scale completely lost. There was no project as dark and menacing as the Abbott Homes. The staircases were the most unsettling, and residents were forced to use them since the elevators were rarely working. While other projects had screened-in ramps allowing some natural light to filter into stairwells, the Abbott staircases were completely enclosed. So when light bulbs were broken or missing, which was most of the time, it was pitch dark in the corridors. For her first 2 years in Abbott Homes, Ruthie Mae shared her two-bedroom apartment with Vernita, her two young children, and Vernita's boyfriend, Lewis Butler. Lewis and Ruthie Mae didn't really get along. At first, things were pleasant, but Lewis always believed that she started comparing him to Vernita's father, who had deserted her. His betrayal became Ruthie's favorite topic of conversation, and needless to say, tension grew. Finally, in 1985, Vernita, Lewis, and the children moved out. Neighbors later stated that Ruthie May became depressed after Vernita left. She missed her grandchildren and started becoming more irritable toward other residents, especially the children. She yelled at those who blast their radios in the hallways, threatening them with a stick that she carried with her. And they, in turn, threatened and ridiculed her. The police had to intervene several times when Ruthie May got into disagreements. She lived in constant fear of being mugged or burglarized. She requested the CHA change her locks at least twice after Vernita moved out. She seemed obsessed with locks, and neighbors described how she sometimes toured the 11th floor, checking doorknobs and lecturing the residents whose doors were unlocked. It was said that if you heard a car alarm blaring near the Abbott homes, it likely wasn't a real thief, but Ruthie May trying to lock a car door that had been left open. Living alone aggravated her fears and intensified her mental problems. She'd started eating irregularly and her weight dropped rapidly. Her behavior became more bizarre. Neighbors told Vernita that during the winter, she was often spotted lying in the snow, spreading her arms and legs to make snow angels. And on hot summer days, she often wore a winter coat and several pairs of pants. On August 10th, 1986, Ruthie May arrived at Rush Presbyterian Hospital with Vernita's older child, 4-year-old Bobby. He had deep cuts on his face, arms, and legs. Ruthie May said that she'd been babysitting and Bobby fell down some stairs, but her apparently peculiar behavior raised red flags among the emergency room staff, and the Department of Child and Family Services was called. When Ruthie May found this out, she went berserk, becoming so violent she had to be placed in restraints. The hospital was able to reach Vernita, who quickly came to pick up Bobby and sign commitment papers for her mother. Ruthie May was taken to the nearby Illinois State Psychiatric Institute. In the end, DCFS never opened a case, but Vernita was certain that Ruthie May hadn't abused her son. And those who knew her agreed that while Ruthie May could be strict with her grandchildren, she was always warm and caring toward them. Well, at the psychiatric hospital, Ruthie May was diagnosed as a residual type schizophrenic. This condition is characterized by an absence of prominent behavioral problems, but there still might be symptoms like social isolation, strange behavior, vague or digressive speech, and odd beliefs, usually about religion and superstitions. She was discharged on September 18th and was advised about getting follow-up care at the Mount Sinai Psychiatric Center. Well, Ruthie May went to the center for the first time 5 days later. The psychiatrist who interviewed her found indications of schizophrenia, but not enough to make it clear that she was suffering from that illness. Ruthie's hygiene was good, her communication skills were fine, but she was also extremely frightened and distrustful. She also became frustrated and upset by what it took to simply run her life. For instance, she'd get a letter from some agency in the mail and wouldn't know what it was, so she'd become frantic, thinking her welfare money was about to be cut off. She wasn't illiterate, but the letters were so confusing to her, she'd have to take them to her psychiatrist to interpret them for her. But the help she received from the center was exactly what she needed. She started going there 3 times a week and participated in GED classes, craft projects, and group therapy sessions. Because of her age, the GED teacher was skeptical when she signed up for the classes, but Ruthie proved to be a bright student and a quick learner. By April 1987, she was already at the 9th grade level, and with a few more months of study, she would have earned her GED certificate. Neighbors in her building noticed the changes in Ruthie May, too. They saw that she put on some weight and was dressing and acting more appropriately. She was rarely angry with people anymore. She stopped shouting at kids in the hallways and seemed more enthusiastic about her life. She told some of them that as soon as she got her GED, she was going to find a real job and get her life together. She knew more than anything that she needed to get out of the projects, but she couldn't afford to leave. Her apartment cost only $46 a month, but she only received $154 a month from welfare. She just couldn't pay for anything better. Yet. She'd started receiving Social Security in February and hoped the extra money would finally get her out of the Abbott homes. But of course, that never happened. When Ruthie reached 911 operators on April 22nd, she gave them her address and tried to explain what was happening. "Some people next door are totally tearing this down, you know." "What are they doing, ma'am?" asked the dispatcher. Ruthie May's reply was unintelligible on the tape, but the dispatcher seemed to understand. "They want to break in?" he asked. "Yes, they throwed the cabinet down," Ruthie cried. The dispatcher then asked, "From where?" Ruthie replied again, "I'm in the projects. I'm on the other side. You can reach my bathroom. They want to come through the bathroom." "All right," the dispatcher said. "At what address?" Ruthie gave her address again and added she was in apartment 1109. He wrote down her name and told her he would send the police. But the dispatcher wasn't sure what it was that Ruthie was reporting. He didn't understand what she meant by "they throwed the cabinet down and they want to come through the bathroom." Even so, he ended the call so he could send a patrol car to the address. He assigned a 12th District car to answer a disturbance with a neighbor complaint, not an attempted break-in, which might explain why the police hadn't yet arrived at Ruthie May's apartment at 9:02 p.m. when another 911 call came in about apartment 1109. This one came from a woman who'd been walking down the hall and heard gunshots inside the apartment. Well, at 9:04 p.m., another neighbor called to report gunshots and screams in apartment 1109. Soon, two more police cars were on the way to the scene. Four officers finally arrived at Ruthie's door at about 9:10 p.m. They pounded on the door, announced their presence, and shouted for Ruthie May. There was no answer. They asked the dispatcher to call her phone, and the officers outside heard the phone in the apartment ring and ring over and over. No one picked it up. There were two more officers downstairs, and they drove to the project office located a block away to get a key for 1109. They hurried back, but it was the wrong key. It didn't fit the lock. This left the cops wondering what to do. They considered breaking open the door, but decided to try talking to neighbors instead. No one answered across the hall, the apartment next door was vacant, and neighbors in an apartment down the hallway said they hadn't seen or heard anything out of the ordinary. All they learned from other neighbors was that an elderly woman lived alone in apartment 1109. The officers contacted the project office again, but the janitor there had no other key for 1109. And so, at 9:48 p.m., the police broke down the door, rushed inside, and prevented Ruthie May's death from a pair of unknown intruders. Actually, no, they didn't. What really happened at 9:48 p.m. was that the police officers left Ruthie May's building and went back on patrol. The following evening, though, another 911 call was made, this time by Deborah Lasley, one of Ruthie's 11th floor neighbors. Deborah said that Ruthie normally stopped by her apartment on her way out of the building every morning and when she returned in the afternoon. But this day, she hadn't stopped by at all. And since Deborah had seen the police outside Ruthie's door the night before, she was now worried. About a half dozen CPD officers and four or five CHA security guards arrived at Ruthie's door a short time later. Their knocks and calls went unanswered. Again. Neighbors later stated that most of the police officers wanted to break down the door, but the security guards discouraged this. One of them raised the possibility of a tenant suing the police if they broke in. Besides, if you bust down the door, the security guards told the cops, you'll have to get someone up here to secure it. Isn't that their job as security guards? Anyway, the police officer shrugged and left again. The next day, Deborah Lasley called the project office about her concerns. Finally, around 1 p.m., a project official came to Ruthie's door with a carpenter who drilled open the lock. It was this official and the carpenter, not the police, who found Ruthie May in her bedroom, lying on her side in a pool of blood, a hand over her chest and one shoe on and one shoe off. Papers, magazines, and coins were scattered around her on the floor. When the police later turned Ruthie May slightly, the faint smell of rotting flesh began to seep through the apartment. Ruthie May had been shot 4 times. One bullet passed through her left shoulder, another passed through her left thigh. A third entered the right side of her abdomen, pierced her liver, and exited the left side of her body. The fourth and fatal bullet passed through her right arm, then entered her chest and severed her pulmonary vein. The doctor who performed the autopsy said that Ruthie likely didn't die immediately, but probably wouldn't have survived even if she'd been discovered that night. Which, of course, she wasn't. The death of Ruthie Mae McCoy didn't cause a sensation in the city. In fact, it was barely covered in the papers. Murders in the projects weren't big news. Residents died every week, even 2 or 3 times a week in warm weather. And so Ruthie May became just another resident who'd been shot, knifed, or beaten to death in late April 1987. The murder didn't really get much coverage at all until the 2 suspects in her murder were arrested and indicted. And that only became newsworthy because detectives had determined that Ruthie May's killers had entered her apartment through her medicine cabinet. They'd removed the cabinet in the adjacent apartment where some addicts had been hanging out and broke through Ruthie May's cabinet and climbed through the wall into her apartment. The article, which ran in the Chicago Tribune, also became notorious for the fact that it reported that Ruthie May had heard intruders breaking in and had called 911. Someone else had also called 911 and reported gunshots from the apartment, but then when the police arrived, they knocked on the door, got no answer, and left. Her body was discovered 2 days later, the article read. And that was it. That's the last time Ruthie's murder was reported in any Chicago newspaper. And this wasn't a surprise at the time. In CHA Towers, babies had been tossed out of windows and teenagers had been shoved down elevator shafts. Residents were raped and murdered by intruders all the time, so there wasn't much that seemed unusual about an old lady and a medicine cabinet murder. But Abbott residents were shocked by the method of Ruthie May's murder, even if they weren't that surprised by it. Such break-ins had been happening for about a year, largely because they were so simple. Narrow passages had been built into the walls between apartments that were supposed to allow easy access to maintenance workers, but now burglars were using them too. The cheaply made cabinets, secured by only 6 nails, were easily removed, allowing access to the adjacent apartment after its cabinet was pushed into the next bathroom. Intruders then slithered through the wall from one apartment to the other. When the dispatcher had answered Ruthie May's call for help, he didn't understand what she was trying to tell him and dismissed the danger, which is what prompted criticism that she'd been failed by the 911 system. And then she'd been failed again by the police, who didn't bother to enter her apartment. In May of that same year, Nancy Clay, a white, suburban, white-collar office worker, was killed in a Loop high-rise fire, and indications that the 911 system had failed her prompted weeks of media coverage, a city council investigation, a special hearing with testimony from the fire commissioner, and radio and TV broadcasts. But the performance of the 911 dispatcher and the police in Ruthie May's case didn't even merit a departmental investigation. It wouldn't be until writer Steve Bogera did his own investigation into the case in the Chicago Reader that the police responded to the officer's actions by not really responding at all. Steve was assured that everyone would be questioned and investigated, but that was all he was told. When he later inquired about the progress of the investigation, he was told there wasn't one, nor was there a need for one. He was simply told that if the 911 call had come from anywhere other than the projects, officers would have forcibly entered the apartment. But because so many 911 calls from the projects were hoaxes, a spokesman said, officers had to choose a course of action. He was assured that no one had done anything wrong. But of course, he didn't believe it, which led to his acclaimed Reader article, which was called They Came In Through the Bathroom Mirror. It was the only real publicity that Ruthie Mae's story ever received. Well, until that movie came along. The story from which the film Candyman was adapted was written by Clive Barker in 1985, and it was called The Forbidden. It's about a public housing tower in Liverpool, England, where the phrase, "sweets to the sweet," could be found tagged on the doors of the tower's many abandoned flats. The housing development, once known for its beauty, had fallen into disrepair, and residents were unnerved by the graffiti, which started to be studied by a student named Helen. Using her camera, she captured not only the decay of the buildings, but the graffiti, and soon begins to believe that the messages are hiding something sinister. Urged to find more information about recent murders in the tower, she begins hunting for a legendary figure known as the Candyman. But it's not long before the legend is hunting her. When the film was adapted, many key elements were never changed. It kept the names of the main characters the same, the design of the Candyman mural, and certain plot points. There's no origin for Candyman in the story, but the phrase, "be my victim," certainly remains. The setting of the film would become the greatest change. It moved from Liverpool to Cabrini Green in Chicago. Candyman became black, and real-life elements of the city in the late 80s and early 90s were incorporated into the plot. One of those elements was the murder of Ruthie Mae McCoy. In the film, a character named Ruthie Jean is a resident of Cabrini Green who's murdered after someone comes through her bathroom mirror and kills her. Like the real-life Ruthie Mae McCoy, Ruthie Jean's neighbors consider her crazy. She also called the police, who left her alone to die. But how did the writers of the film discover this barely reported murder and move the production from England to Chicago? Well, it was pretty obvious to Chicago Reader contributor Steve Bergero when the film came out. He couldn't miss the Ruthie Jean reference or the name of Ruthie's neighbor, Anne-Marie McCoy, or that Ruthie Jean was killed when an intruder broke in through her bathroom mirror. In the film, a newspaper, the fictional Chicago Dispatch, is spotted and it displays the headline, "Who, What Killed Ruthie Jean?" The subheading reads, "Life in the Projects." Chronicling the horrors of life in the projects and the plight of the poverty-stricken residents had been his plan when he'd written the article. But it still begs the question of how the filmmakers had found his story. According to Bagheera, he'd received a call from actor John Malkovich a few months after the article came out. He'd been in town for a production at the Steppenwolf Theater when the story was published, and he'd read it. Malkovich saw a movie in it, and the two men met up to discuss it. Malkovich told him that he was struck by the description of the Abbott homes and wanted to bring it to life for audiences who had no idea of the nightmarish conditions in the projects. He was interested in directing or helping produce the film. When Bergera said he was okay with pursuing it, Malkovich told him he'd proposed a general idea to a few producers, and then when Steve didn't hear back from him, he assumed that no one had been interested. He added that when Candyman came out in 1992, he paid no attention to it until someone pointed out the parallels between the film and Ruthie Mae's story. He assumed that one of Malkovich's Hollywood chats eventually made their way to the producers of Candyman, who incorporated the story into the film and its public housing development setting. And he was almost right. The film's director, Bernard Rowe, said that when he was researching the history of some of Chicago's housing projects, he'd run across the story of a killer who came into an apartment through a medicine cabinet. Obviously, it was Steve's story. So why move the Chicago setting away from the Abbott homes where the real story happened to Cabrini Green? Although no one has ever said, if I had to guess, I'd say it was about access. The crew got permission to film at Cabrini Green, likely because it was less dangerous than the Abbott homes, which were torn down just a few years later. Although the term less dangerous didn't mean much when it came to Cabrini Green. Cabrini Green was located on the city's near north side and, like the other projects, was built and expanded in the 1950s and 60s. The CHA wanted public housing to be for both white and black residents of modest means. It had been suggested they be set up in a variety of neighborhoods, including white middle-class areas. But white aldermen weren't about to allow public housing projects in their wards, so the projects filled with African Americans on public aid. As too often happens with projects started with the best intentions, Cabrini Green fell apart. When it first opened, it had new modern apartments with gas stoves, hot water, and indoor plumbing, which was usually a step up from the places where most residents had lived in the past. Public housing at the time was presented as a marvel of modern architecture and social reform. Cabrini Green even appeared in the television show Good Times. You know, the Dynamite, Jimmy, J.J. Walker thing? Yeah. And it appeared to show a good standard of living for African Americans in those days. But racism and neglect turned the place into a nightmare. By the early 90s, more than 15,000 people were living in abject poverty just blocks away from Chicago's downtown. The buildings at Cabrini Green had become run down and dilapidated. The elevators no longer worked. Lights and utilities were frequently turned off. Street gangs openly sold drugs in doorways, and robbery and even murder became commonplace. Around the time that Candyman premiered in 1992, only 9% of Cabrini Green residents had jobs. The rest relied on public assistance and crime to survive. When the film crew came to shoot the disturbing interior scenes at Cabrini Green, they didn't have to do much to make them scary. Decades of neglect had already done the job for them. Director Bernard Rowe said that when the crew first went to Cabrini Green, they went with a full police escort. But eager to see the neighborhood from a different perspective, Rowe later returned there alone and became acquainted with a woman who lived there. She provided the inspiration for the character of Anne Marie, whose infant son is abducted by Candyman in the movie. Rose also used real life for another element of the story when he discovered that the nearby Sandburg Village was architecturally identical to Cabrini Green, with the only difference being that one was turned into condos and the other became public housing. While the screenwriters didn't look far to find a story like that of Ruthie Mae McCoy, they also didn't have to look far to find inspiration for the origin story of Candyman, a black man named Daniel who was murdered because of his illicit affair with a white woman in 1890. He'd been an artist hired to paint the portrait of a wealthy man's daughter, and the two of them fell in love. When this was discovered, her father hired a gang to beat him, saw off his hand and replace it with a hook, and then he was covered in honey and bees stung him to death. And of course, he later returns from the grave as Candyman. Of course, this seems far-fetched, but it wasn't. Well, there aren't a lot of real-life accounts of black men returning from the grave looking for vengeance, but danger for interracial couples, well, that was all too real in American history. During the late 19th and early 20th centuries, white mobs sometimes took their anger out on African Americans, leading to murder, lynchings, and race riots. In 1890, the year cited in the film when Daniel Robitaille was hired to paint that portrait, 85 Black American men were killed in lynchings. And no man, regardless of how famous he was immune from the racism of the era. World-famous boxer Jack Johnson was hounded by a white mob in Chicago after marrying a white woman in 1911. He survived, but many others in the same situation did not. The filmmakers used the long history of white people who painted black men as being physically imposing to justify their fears to their advantage. Tony Todd, who played Candyman, was a black man who stood 6'5" tall and had a deep, resonant voice. No one who's ever seen the film has ever forgotten his intense portrayal of the character. But when Helen first sees him in the parking garage, his classic wide-legged stance was used to make him take up more space and seem physically threatening. His love for the white woman he couldn't have in life and Candyman's obsession with Helen are deeply sexual. He had a very clear desire to claim Helen spiritually and physically, hypnotically pleading with her to, quote, allow me at least a kiss. When Candyman appeared in 1992, it wasn't an automatic classic for all black audiences. A few black filmmakers and critics expressed concerns about the filmmaker's willingness to lean into those stereotypes about black men. One even called it, quote, irresponsible and racist. Candyman's extreme violence, mostly toward the black residents of Cabrini Green, is central to the character and to the character of the film, which sparked concerns about how racial violence was being exploited in the movie. It wouldn't be until the 2021 sequel to the film, directed by Nia DaCosta, a director of color, when some of the problematic elements of the 92 film were addressed and utilized in other ways. Bernard Rose, though, has always said he wanted the film to be grounded in reality. And the racial subtext of the film, it came out of that. It was added in from the original story, which was more about politics and class differences. The racial element was added because of the location and used Cabrini Green as an added layer of dread in the storyline. The film, he said, offered up an extension of one of the original themes of the story, which was the fear of poverty. Inequality and oppression created a fear among the oppressors because they're afraid of one day being called to account. And he added, quote, the film is about that in some ways, and that's why it's still powerful. But I did not have any sort of agenda except to try and represent what I'd seen in Chicago as realistically as possible. The real-life events, people, and places that inspired Candyman are arguably more terrifying than anything we see on screen. There may not have been an actual Candyman, but the character was constructed out of many parts of history, violence, mythology, and from stories like that of Ruthie Mae McCoy and countless others. We often say that truth is stranger than fiction, but in this case, it's definitely more heartbreaking, too. Stay with us for the rest of the show after enjoying these important messages from our sponsors.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to paint their door a vibrant shade of blue. Others have the need to decorate their bathroom with fish, anchors, and other nautical items. And because each homeowner has unique needs, Geico helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with Geico.
Have you ever heard of Candyman? And if you look in the mirror, and you say his name 5 times.
In cities everywhere.
Candyman.
They whisper his name.
Right. Candyman.
It's just a story.
Candyman.
Candyman.
Just a ghost story.
Candyman.
An entire community starts attributing the daily horrors of their lives to a mythical figure.
The legend first appeared in 1890. He was attacked, mutilated, and burned to death. Poor Candyman.
Helen, a woman died in there. Leave it.
Everyone knows he isn't real.
That's modern oral folklore.
Everyone except Helen Lyle.
Where did I get
it? It ain't safe around here.
That don't scare too easy. Y'all know about Ruthie Jean? They ain't never gonna catch him. Who? Candyman.
Helen.
Who is that?
I came for you.
Do I know you?
Now, she is about to discover.
Helen?
What's behind the mystery?
I'm sick.
What's behind the legend?
Listen, he's under the bed!
And most terrifying of all,
come with me.
What's behind the mirror?
She's here.
Candyman, you don't have to believe. Just beware.
Welcome back to the American Haunties podcast, and thanks for being with us for the last segment of the show. My name is Troy Taylor, and as mentioned, I'm the guy behind American Haunties, and I wrote and narrated this episode, which would have never made it to your ear holes without my friend, producer, editor, and co-host, Cody Beck.
I get ear holes. I say ear holes. Why does it bother me to hear somebody else say ear holes?
I don't know. I just thought it was funny. I don't even know why. It just popped into my head when I was putting that together.
Yes, so. Through one of your ear holes, probably.
Probably so.
Oh, Troy, we were just talking about the weather off air.
Yeah, the improvement.
It's been changing my mood. I've noticed a difference in other people's moods. I see
changes everybody's around. Mood.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, the seasonal depression starts to finally slow down. Yeah.
Well, I mean, you know, and we're getting close to the time change, you know, yes. The good time change where we actually get more light instead of less.
Right.
And that I think improves people's moods as well. So
it does. Like I mentioned earlier, I was kind of moving around my apartment depending on where I wanted to work and stuff. And sometimes I am following the sun a little bit.
Yeah. Just hoping for light. A little less seasonal sadness, you know?
Yes, yes, exactly. But speaking of seasonal sadness or the antidote to it, you've got some other things in the works coming up. What's going on with you, man?
Well, my new book's out, that One Night in Phoenix book, which is not a cheery story, as we know.
Right.
A woman cuts up her friends, puts them in a trunk. But a lot more to that story turned out to be a lot crazier than we had it in the podcast. A lot more to it. So anyway, book's out. If you're interested, check it out. It's called One Night in Phoenix, and it is available from the main website at AmericanHauntings.net. Also, as far as celebrations go in spring and all that, March 8th, which is 2 weeks away, something like that, is the first anniversary of the American Oddities Museum.
Beautiful.
So we've officially been open 1 year now. So we're going to have a book signing and a store-wide sale. I got a new exhibit that's opening. I've got the first 100 people get a American Oddities Museum book bag, and they're nice book bags. They're not like those, you know, the cheapy ones that we, let's be honest, that we hand out at the conference because they're, you know, this one's also free, but it's like a heavy canvas one. So it's really nice. Yeah. So come by, get there, be there, be one of the people who gets a book bag. Cody's going to be there. I didn't clear that with him. I just said he was, but
yeah, I will though.
Just assume he's going to stop by. So yeah, it's going to be fun. It's going to be fun. So, and you know, as winter turns to spring, a lot more things going on. So we got our first Ghosts of the River Road tour of the whole year. First of the year coming up, March 21st. We've got the Alton Seance, which is going to be cool. We've never done it before. It's brand new. It's a new thing. And I'm really looking forward to it. And the more I think about it, the more fun it's going to be because I've been kind of like plotting things. And then like stumbled across something that is very rare, that I've only ever had one before that I've ever owned. And then I put it in the raffle, but my friend Amanda Woomer ended up with it. So I didn't feel too bad, but I found another one in the wild. So I'm excited about it, not giving it away, staying in the museum, but you know, it's gonna be a really fun hands-on kind of thing. So anyway, Spirit Communication, all that, check it out. And then we've got dinners coming up, Edgar Allan Poe, American Witch. We've got a brand new sideshow circus carnival dinner that I'm doing at the end of March. So yeah, it's looking up, you know, as spring starts to spring. Or sprung, or however that works. Anyway, just go to dinnerandspirits.com and you'll find all those events listed there, along with our anniversary thing, too.
So, that's awesome. Yeah, I was thinking about the anniversary stuff, and I'm like, okay, what do you get your friend for his 1 year oddities? Is there a Hallmark card?
I don't think so. I don't think there is. So,
congrats on your freaky museum.
Yeah, managing to keep this thing open for a year. So, you know, congratulations on moving all that crap out of your house. Yeah, there you go. So that's kind of it. So
that's the thing. I don't think I haven't seen I haven't been to your place or any places like in a long time. So I'm so curious now as to like what is all in the museum versus like what.
Well, I could tell you that my personal living space does fit into a smaller space than it used to.
Nice.
I will say that I went from like warehouse loft to, you know, actual house. So it does make a difference to have it somewhere else.
Yeah.
So, yeah, but it does make it just kind of hard to just pick up one day and disappear without a trace. You know, pack a bag and head for Mexico or something. It makes it a little harder these days, but
yeah.
Oh, well.
Well, that's the thing too, with the disappearing without a trace is, you and I have talked a lot about that. You've done a lot more research on that, but still most of the conclusions we come to are, we don't really know how they did it. So.
Yeah. It is kind of difficult. You're right. So,
yeah.
I mean, it is something that I, you know, contemplated a number of times, but I've always declined to do it because, well, I can't take all my books with me, things like that. So it makes it a little tough.
Like when I'm helping you like unload the Jeep or something, and I'm like, okay, these backpacks, you're like, no, those are the ones that stay. And I'm
right.
Troy's go bags. I forget.
The emergency go bags.
No. Hey, I wanted to give some shout outs to our new subscribers on Patreon. So thank you very much for supporting the show to Jacob, Joshua, Catherine, Barbara, Lynn, Tracy, Stephanie, and Amy, thanks for being our new patrons and subscribers.
Yeah. And if you don't know about our Patreon program, you can check it out at patreon.com/AmericanHauntings. And we actually do an alternate podcast to this one. And we're almost ready for episode 4 of season 5. So there's a bunch of seasons already on there of mayhem and murder. Our new season is called Monster, and it is the true story of Albert Fish, which has already been grim and is just getting grimmer and grosser as it goes. But anyway, that show is also every other week, and we've got it fit so it falls in between this show. So you can actually get a new episode of American Hauntings every week if you're a Patreon subscriber. So anyway, check it out. We have a lot of people that have discovered it and have joined us on there. So if you want to check it out, like I said, it's patreon.com/AmericanHauntings.
Awesome. Yeah. And speaking of Patreon, a lot of shirts have been sent out, and then some other people have reached out to me about single shirts. And so that's all in the works. So anybody that's reached out by now, you should have had something has happened. I'll tell you with your email. There's been some response or something. So please, nobody worry or fret about all that. And I'm glad
that's like me trying to reassure people. Yes, I swear I've mailed it. So your book's in the mail.
No. It's always like the check and the book. They're always
always in the mail.
In the mail. Okay, Candyman. This is
you want to talk about this?
Yeah.
Now I'm going to be very careful because I don't want to accidentally say that name, the name of the movie, five times during this
Although I'm not looking in a mirror right now. So, although, ooh, this might count because Does we are count? Looking yeah. at our screens. So, and my face is in there.
And we've seen some, there were a couple good, over Skype type Zoom, like usually a quarantine movies that came out. Remember those?
Yeah, Host. And still worth rewatching, even though, and I try not to think about the quarantine lockdown too often anymore. Right. Try to put that out of my memory, at least until the next one comes along. I still watch it. So, I still watch that movie. It's a good one.
Yeah, and I've known that this is one of your favorites. You've been very vocal about that since day one. And
yeah, we did a 90s episode of one of our Halloween shows one time, best films of the 90s, and this was definitely on there.
So, yes.
Yeah, and love this movie.
And I really appreciate the detail you put into it and talk about the social political issues and things and inspirations for it. What, two better people to talk about that than us, but it's still, it's important.
Two stupid white people, but two white guys. But I think people understand, I mean, there's a reason why those projects are gone now. I mean, I think that people woke up to the fact that they were not, it's just like, so many times over the years we've talked about, the big insane asylums that got started and things like that. I mean, all that stuff was done with the best of intentions. And honestly, this was too. I mean, it wasn't just it wasn't meant to be a concentration camp or something. It was meant to be a place where, people who were at an economic disadvantage would have a decent, nice place to live. And, over time, just like so many other programs, that have come along over the years, it gets bumped or ignored or, underfunded or whatever. And it just, they became a nightmare. All of them did. I mean, the people, who live there could tell you the same thing. They started out great. And, they started out, not as a place, let's put all the black people in one place. It wasn't like that. I mean, there were black and white families who lived in those places, especially after World War II. Mm-hmm. A lot of people were, had come home from the war. There was a housing shortage. And, people who didn't have a lot of money, moved into places like that and moved into these different projects and cities all across the country. But unfortunately, they just kind of, got run down and overtaken by gangs and all kinds of stuff. So, they became a nightmare of their own. And, this story about, Ruthie Mae McCoy is a bit of a heartbreaking story. I mean, she definitely needed help she wasn't getting. But again, nobody was set up to do that kind of thing at the time. It just wasn't. It wasn't a thing.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah. And I think it's still important to, even if it's us talking about these things, because whenever they had, the other Candyman come out, I believe it was Jordan Peele produced or something like that.
Yeah,
I
remember DaCosta did. Yeah,
a lot of people were still saying, no, it's being too political. It's pushing too much of it. And we're like, hold on a second.
Right. No. Yeah. And it wasn't meant to be political at all. It was kind of looking at some of the things that the first film fumbled a bit on, which it did because it was the time period. Again, you cannot. Once more, I know I've said this on the podcast a zillion times already, but you cannot judge the, how things were done in the past by the standards of today.
Right.
It's not the same. And so in 1992, when they're putting this film together, a bunch of white guys, the director was white, the writer was white, they're putting these films together and they're doing the best they can with it and trying to show stuff in a sympathetic light. Like with the character of Anne Marie and things. But on the other hand, some things got fumbled and they realized it belatedly. And, Nia DaCosta, a woman of color doing the movie, makes a difference, and so she tried to do things a little differently. And I find that the sequel is just as effective as the first one.
Oh, absolutely.
I think it's a great film. And, The first one just always stuck with me so much because while I did not know the story of Ruthie McCoy, I did not know that story until later. Mm-hmm. I knew Cabrini Green. I knew all this stuff in Chicago, you know. So watching this movie and seeing all these very familiar places to me made it that much more frightening, mm-hmm. you know, because it seemed like it could, I would say real. I mean, obviously this is a, you know, an urban legend that comes to life and jumps out of a mirror and kills people, but you recognize the real life horrifying elements of it, because mm-hmm. Cabrini Green was, man, it was right close to downtown. It was not far off, you know? And I think that when it was planned, I'm sure that, like in the movie, that wasn't how they planned it. That wasn't how it was supposed to be. You know, they wanted to, you know, kind of keep it to the side. And now, I mean, you drive by, we used to drive by there, and when it was still standing, of course, it's long gone now. There's nothing left of it, you know, and they did, you know, move that kind of housing out into other parts of the city. And well, you see that in the second film, even, mm-hmm. you know, they kind of cover that whole thing with the towers are gone. So,
right. And yeah, and something so interesting to me about this is, regardless of your mental health at the time or not, still someone came through the mirror.
And right. Exactly. Somebody. Exactly. Yeah. So, I mean, you know, them accusing her, oh, she's crazy. Well, she probably sounded crazy when you're telling somebody that there's someone coming through your wall.
Yeah. Yeah.
They're coming out of my bathroom mirror. Well, yeah, of course, people are going to think you're crazy. But the sad thing was, is that the people who lived in that building didn't think she was, I mean, they thought she was a little odd anyway, because sure. she did have some, you know, she did have some issues that she did get help for, and her life was actually improving. And then now you've got, you know, people thinking you're nuts because you've got, you're calling the police and telling somebody's coming through your mirror. But people who lived in the building, that kind of break-in had been going on already for almost of the year already when it happened. And so they knew that people had found access to get through those mirrors.
Yeah.
But when it happened, when the movie came out, it was still a shock to most people, because, you know, there was that Reader article that talked about it. Mm-hmm. But other than that, it got no publicity in the wider public. So it almost seemed too hard to believe in the movie.
Right.
Even though it was absolutely real.
Of course. And yeah, and it's kind of like, you know, if you know somebody really well, you can kind of tell, is this them maybe having an episode or being the usual self, or is, okay, sure. this is something new. This is a different level
right.
of, you know, something right. you got to take more seriously or consider differently. And yeah. And I'm trying to think of the right word to call that tactic of going through the wall. Because I don't want to use anything that has a positive connotation, but it's,
well, yeah, yeah. Right. 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 It is creative. Yeah, that's true.
Yeah. And something that would take, I wouldn't have necessarily thought about something like that. It's wild.
You know, and it's, I mean, that in itself was kind of a structural failure that I don't think anybody probably thought could ever happen or, sure. you know, even imagine would happen, because it was really just to get access to that, you know, that kind of maintenance walkway between the building, mm-hmm. between the apartments. But what really failed her was when, you know, she had spent some time, and yes, she'd had a lot of mental issues.
She had a hard life.
She had her hard life. But she had also, you know, really everybody said, oh, she was obsessed with locks. Well, for good reason.
Yeah.
And the thing was, she was trying to help people. You know, they'd say, oh, if you hear a car alarm going off, it's just Ruthie. She's making sure she's locking your door for you. Mm. Or if she goes up and down your hallway, she's up on the 11th floor of a tower she didn't want to be on. And she was going up and down the hallway, checking people's doors. And if she found them to be unlocked, she'd lecture them about keeping their door locked. So when something does happen, her neighbors also call the police, mm-hmm. who still don't respond. Well, okay, they respond by showing up and knocking on her door. Now, there had been screaming, crying, gunshots mm-hmm. being recorded, but no one opens the door.
By multiple people at that point.
Yeah. They try to get a key up, wrong key. Well, it's because she'd had her locks changed like two times for whatever reason. But again, the maintenance, nobody can get into the apartment. They come back the next day. Still, nobody goes in. even though now there's another call and nobody goes in. Finally, it's the third day and it's an official from the apartment building and like a, you know, maintenance
carpenter
man,
yeah,
who shows up and drills the lock and goes in and finds the body. Unbelievable. I mean, that in itself, I think that's what, you know, this didn't get a lot of press when it happened. I mean, that Reader article that I reference is probably the really about it. It got a couple of mentions in the newspaper because of the novelty of climbing through the wall. But really, where were the people who were should have been flipping out about the fact that, you know, it took 3 days before someone actually opened the door and found her inside because they didn't want to get sued? Are you kidding me?
Right.
You know, and nobody'd seen her in 3 days either. That's the thing. I mean, it'd been one thing if you know, the night of the call and the cops show up and they bust the door down and it's somebody in there watching their TV too loud. That I get. But, you know, after people had called and heard gunshots from an older lady who is not got a blaring TV, right, and, you know, and nobody'd seen her in 3 days, it's time to open the door.
Yeah.
You know, so
it's a wellness check.
And then there was no, I mean, you know, they told that the guy who wrote the Reader article, oh yeah, we're investigating, we're trying to find out why the cops didn't go in. And then when he calls to check to say, okay, so what's the story? Oh no, we're not investigating. There's no reason to, you know, he's just stunned. I mean, the guy is stunned. I've seen him interviewed and I've read some follow-up stuff that he's written because he's a really interesting writer. And, you know, what's funny, white guy.
Oh yeah.
It's a white guy who's mad about all this, you know, and it's just, you know, he interviewed family members and neighbors and all kinds of stuff. And, you know, it's amazing that nothing really more came from that, at least to me. I don't know. I'm just kind of shocked by the whole thing. You know, I still am.
Well, it's also that, like, you know, this is just a sad truth, but it's like a lot of times when a white person gets pissed off, then something gets more attention. Or, you know,
well, that's true. That's right? True. Well, he referenced the lady who was in the office worker who was in the loop, a white office worker, and there was a fire in the building. And then the 911 system failed. And when it did, there was weeks of media coverage, city council investigation,
right,
special hearing on the live on the radio and all kinds of stuff. But not a single thing was ever done. And then so Ruthie Mae gets one article, right, you know, and a couple of mentions in the paper and that's it. So I don't know, man. And I'm not even going to say it's a black and white thing. I think it's a have and have not thing more
sure.
than that.
I mean,
you know, and who's voting, you know,
right,
white suburban office workers or, you know, an elderly black lady who, you know, lives in a project high rise, you
right.
know. Where are the voters at? Well, the voters are the, you know, people who work in the loop. So
yep.
I don't know. Yeah, it's a really sad story. It really is. But it kind of goes to show you the mess that it had to be before it got at least somewhat fixed up.
Sure.
You know, cleaned up.
And the sad story, you said, is then taken and adopted and written by Clive Barker, who does the Hellraiser movies, right?
Yes,
and
yes. Well, yeah, yeah. He's done a lot
among other things, but yeah.
Yeah, among other things. That was, I mean, that was what he was mostly known by when the movie came out, was mm-hmm. Hellraiser. I don't think, oh, yeah, by that point, I guess Nightbreed had come out, which
yes, I just
problematic.
Saw that one pop up. Yeah.
Lord of Illusions, I think, which I do like that one. It's got some cheesy effects, but Nightbreed is a weird animal.
Yeah, I don't know about it. I've just saw it pop
yeah,
up.
I don't know if you've ever seen it or not.
I haven't.
It's there's some really good stuff to it, and then there's some not so good stuff to it.
The poster is
wow. Yeah, it's it definitely shows its 80s age a bit. You know, I know that's not the subject of what we're talking about here, but I do remember. I mean, the idea behind it was cool, is that, you know, it's the monsters that are the good guys, the hiding underground. And this guy learns that he, you know, he seems a normal human guy. And he finds this weird stuff going on. And he finds that he came from this underground city they call Midian, where the monsters go to hide. But they're the good guys. The bad guys are like the cops who invaded. And there's this psychiatrist played by, David Cronenberg.
Oh,
plays, yeah. He plays a psychiatrist. He didn't direct it or anything, but he is in it. And he's actually a serial killer. And so he's a monster, but he doesn't look like one. You see what I mean?
Uh-huh.
So, but the movie was always just kind of, it was okay. It was cool. And then a few years ago, no, it's been more than a few now, but probably a decade or so ago, my son Orin and I got really excited because we heard that they were finally going to release the director's cut of Nightbreed. It was going to be all the footage that had been taken out by the studio, and it really made it a great film. And so we got really excited. I bought a Blu-ray of it. We sat down to watch it. They should have just left it all out.
Oh, no.
It's got like musical numbers in it. It's so bad. If you ever want to watch it, just watch the standard one.
Yep.
It's not bad. And just know that there's another cut that's much worse. But anyway.
Yeah.
Anyway, Candyman, Hellraiser is Hellraiser, the original. And actually, even the second one's pretty good. And there's a lot of sequels that are not. But there's some Candyman sequels, too. But anyway, the original Candyman, I found was much scarier than the original Hellraiser. And again, probably a lot of that came from the fact that I knew the area so well. You know, I mean, I recognized that it was like seeing a horror film in your neighborhood kind of thing, you know, which was unsettling to say the least. But plus that is not the first Virginia Madsen movie that I'd seen, but she was definitely at her hottest when that came out. So
I'm not going to disagree.
Always had a thing for Virginia Madsen, even now. So
still got it. That's amazing. Actually, I just watched Sideways not too long ago.
Oh man, she's so great in Sideways. That speech that she delivers about
when the two of them are sitting in that little
monologue on wine and the earth and God, she's so good in that. And I mean, I really like her. Always have.
No, it's very, very good. I'm you know this, but for the Dead of Winter Festival in 2024, I tried to get a Tony Todd cameo for you.
Oh, that's right.
To surprise you. I
forgot about that.
And eventually I did it within enough time, but it was still, I think, ended up being like 3 days past the due date. And eventually they gave me a refund like a month later.
Oh, too bad.
And then, you know, you passed away.
Yeah, so. Then he passed away. So. I was just about to say that might have had something to do with it. I don't think totally. You, I don't think it was you. I think it's the reason why you didn't get it.
Oh,
so no, so
Cody, you don't think I killed him? You don't think I killed
him? No.
He's like, I can't take any more of these. Fucking
yeah, no more. Cameras. Yeah.
Oh man. Well, there's a lot more we could keep talking
yeah,
about.
Yeah. Did you rewatch this?
I did.
Before the film. Yeah.
Yes. Only the original. I didn't rewatch
if you rewatched the remake.
I thought about it, but that one I'd seen more recently. So
The two sequels that Tony Todd did, the Farewell to the Flesh, the New Orleans one is watchable, but it just kind of messes with the origin story a little bit too much, in my opinion. But the third one is terrible. Unwatchable.
I haven't seen the third one.
I saw it once. I've never watched it again. And have zero interest in ever watching it again. But I do enjoy watching the original and then watching the 2021. Was it 2021? Yeah.
Yes.
Version. That one is also very good. And I have just rewatched both of those. Well, I actually had rewatched the 2021 one probably a month or so ago. So I went ahead and rewatched the original for our purposes here.
Yep.
And it still holds up, man. I mean, there's a couple of things that are a little cheesy. I mean, her makeup job when her hair gets all burned off the end and stuff, but it's a little weak. But aside from that, I love the movie. I love the ending, the way they handled it, how she becomes her own legend. And oh, God, spoiler alert. Sorry, everybody.
On a
movie that's, 33 years old.
Yeah. So as old as I am. Yeah.
Yeah. But it is very good. If you haven't seen it, hopefully we've kind of talked you into giving it a watch. But it's good stuff. Tony Todd is at his best. That is, I find.
Oh, hell yeah.
I find it is definitely my favorite role of his. He's done some other stuff I've liked, but that is definitely his best. So,
yeah, it's great. And, you know, hopefully this conversation, but also the trailer that we tossed in here.
Yes.
This
yes.
episode.
Hopefully yes, because helps. We did get a lot of votes
we did.
On that, I should tell you. I don't know how many people emailed about it, but I got a lot of text messages asking us for to add the trailers in.
Yes.
So
we got good votes on Spotify.
Yeah, I wasn't going to read them all on here because most of it was like, hell yes to trailers and right. please include the trailers. And there's a couple of comments that are worth mentioning in our when we get to the haunt line. But for the most part, I got nothing from anyone who said don't put in a trailer. So
yeah, exactly. Well, I do want to I want to jump to some of those, but real quick, I do have it's because it's now time for our Ghostwriter segment. So I have if you have a question or comment about the world of macabre, email us at AmericanHauntingsPodcast@gmail.com. I got a real quick one. This one's from Nicole, and it's titled "A Letter from Andrew Lloyd Webber to the Corinthians." It says, "Hey, Cody, if you need to commiserate on how uncomfortable this movie made society, this is a video of one of my favorite podcasts talking on cats.
Cats
for an hour straight. It was live stream, so it starts around 6:15. But this one of the things is I wanted to give a shout out to How Did This Get Made, because I think it's a phenomenal podcast. But also they did an episode on cats, which I have heard before, and it's amazing. And they feel the same way, they're similar to the way I do, that it is mind-blowingly baffling. Don't get me wrong, it's mostly bad, but it's not one of those things that's I wouldn't be talking about it so much if it was just bad. It's just insane.
So if you
ever want to check that out,
Well, and what makes it so bad, though, is that, I mean, there's so many times I'll watch a trailer to something that's obviously either an independent thing or is like four guys who decided to make a movie.
Yeah.
And then you think, how did that get made? Well, it got made because no one could stop them. You know what I mean? They had no overseeing. No, there was no higher power they had to answer to except for their credit card company when they ran up bills trying to pay for their movie. That I get. It's the ones that are like a big studio released. And you're right. Like, what in the world? Why? You know? And that's where Cats falls in my opinion is right in there.
Totally agree. So if you want to check it out, if you need something to break your brain for a little bit, if you find it's just streaming, sure.
Sometimes I'll listen to a podcast like that, and
true.
Wait a minute, now I gotta go watch it. You know, so that might do it to you if you end up watching that episode or listening to that episode of the podcast.
That's a very good point. Awesome. Well, hey, do you want to jump into some
sure
of the,
yeah
the
I've got a few messages line? Yeah on the haunt line. If you guys have a question or a comment or got something that you'd like to have answered, you could text us on the haunt line at 217-791-7859, and it might get read on the show, or you might just get an answer, or it might just end up in a pile of votes like a lot of the yes please include trailers in the podcast have. We also have something else that we need to cover too that was related to one of our past haunt line messages from last time. But I did get a couple of comments about the Serpent and the Rainbow episode that we just did. This is from Phil in the 410, and he says yes to the trailers, but Serpent in the Rainbow is one of my favorite movies. I just watched it this afternoon while I was at work. Well, that must be nice to get to watch at work. But I've had the book for a number of years, but have not read it yet. Well, you should. Now here's a reason to read it. Anyway, and then he says, however, I'm going to read it now. Anyway, thanks for what you guys do. Really appreciate it. Let's see. I appreciate the podcast. I consider you guys friends that I've never met. So again, thank you. So that came from Phil. So thanks, Phil. And then we also have a message from our podcast listener of the year, Diana, of course.
No way.
Who also says yes to trailers, which means that we have to go along with it because Diana said so. But she says, I seriously miss the days when Don LaFontaine introduced thousands of movies with in a world where, you know, you know, those always were. So she definitely jumped on that. And I'm going to come back to that in a second, the rest of her message, because it does pertain to something else that we need to talk about. But this one comes to us from the 724, which I believe is Pennsylvania. Anyway, it says, remember back when you asked for movies that scared us when we first saw them? Serpent in the Rainbow.
No shit.
At the top of my terrifying list. Never watched it again, but after listening to this episode, I'm going to watch it. I'm actually looking forward to it. I'll let you know if I make it out alive. So that seems grim.
Can I say real quick, just of course we have to listen to whatever Diana wants us to do. But now when you said like we have to come back, I'm like, are we like in trouble now?
No. We need to talk about Robbie with his book.
Oh, okay.
His missing book. For those of you, if you might remember that he picked up a book. His cousin was a few years older, picked up a book at a book fair. And it was a ghost book. And he was trying to find out what it was, probably written in the late 60s or 70s. Mm-hmm. It was about a ghost replaying a suicide, maybe in a kitchen or a back room. An illustration and a pen and ink drawing of the ghost. Yes, it was a ghost story book. And so I've had just a couple of suggestions. One came from Dina. She is Texas from the 703 in New York. She said, I wanted to see, I adore the podcast, even the messy seasons that will not be named. Uh-huh. Please don't ever delete them. She said, this is a longer message, but I did want to maybe help out Rob from the 757. Is he sure it wasn't scary stories to tell in the dark or even more scary stories? I don't think it was, but she says, those are the only black and white illustrations I can remember from the Scholastic Book Fair. Those things used to scare all of us. If it's not, I hope someone else can help. So that was her comment on that. And then Diana had one too. She said, the book that Robbie was trying to find, I wonder if it was one of those books by Helen Hoke, H-O-K-E. She wrote tons of creepy short stories about ghosts for middle grade readers that had illustrations. Hmm. So that was another possible suggestion. So I don't know. I haven't heard from Robbie as to whether or not he found it, but this is the first time we've had any suggestions. So there's a couple, although I think he would have remembered if it was scary stories to tell in the dark. But I don't know. Maybe not.
That's a more popular one.
Yeah. But Helen Hoke, that could be something to check in on. It's a possibility. So I don't know. Did you say that you've gotten an email or two about that?
I did. I got a couple of texts actually from our buddy Jeff Porter, who is co-founder of Rabbit Grin Productions. And he mentioned Scary Stories to Tell in the Dark.
Okay.
And then I also got a couple other suggestions. One, I sent one of my robots out to look for it, and they mentioned it could be Tales for the Midnight Hour by Judith Bauer Stamper. And then another suggestion we had come in was Haunted Houses by Larry Kettelkamp.
I remember that one. Okay. I remember that book. Let me just for our listeners who are on with us right now, let me just kind of give everybody one more look at this, and maybe it'll jog somebody's memory.
Please.
Robbie says the book in question contained a story called The Bookstore Ghost. That was what you said. Mm-hmm. The illustration in it was a pen and ink drawing of the ghost of a murder victim down in the bookstore basement that scared the absolute hell out of me as a little kid in the late 70s. Another story in the book was about someone who witnesses a ghost replaying a suicide, maybe in a kitchen or back room. The illustration for that one wasn't nearly as bad as the first one. So anyway, he said that his cousin had picked it up at a book fair, and the book would get brought out from time to time when they were growing up, with the bookstore ghost story and illustration really scaring us. So my cousin and I were both grown and gone from our parents' homes by the mid-90s. The book made one last appearance in 94 when they saw it. So he thinks that it was maybe a Scholastic or some kind of book fair book from the late 60s or, you know, sometime in through the mid 70s. As someone who grew up around that same time, I saw a lot of books like that, but this one isn't ringing a bell for me. But I also, by like, you know, fifth grade was had moved into the adult section,
right?
Because I was so messed up. So, which is a lot of what's wrong with me now. So I didn't see a lot of, you know, the kids related books at that time. So I probably just missed it. So,
yeah,
but well, we're looking, I need to put Oren on it too. He might. He might know.
Honestly, that'd be a great idea.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking. So,
man, well, hopefully we can, you know, utilize this audience for something.
Yeah, good. We'll see. Yeah, yeah, right. We're, use the powers for good instead of evil.
Curious.
Yeah, yeah. So, all right, man. Well, I guess let's wrap this episode up. Thanks again for listening, everybody. If you love the show, we hope you'll share it with your friends, neighbors, everyone you know, and encourage them to listen too. And if you do love the show, we also hope you'll go to iTunes and leave us a 5-star review, even if you don't listen on iTunes, as it really helps us get the show out there and encourages more people to join our twisted little family and listen in.
Yes.
Also, it really helps us if you check your iTunes, if that's how you listen, and make sure that the American Hauntings podcast is set to automatically download to your feed. That way you never miss a show, and it also helps us out. And as a thank you for helping us, we do have that discount code that you can use to get 10% off any books, tours, or events you purchase from American Hauntings or from Cody's American Hauntings shirt store, which is also accessible from the AmericanHauntings.net website. Just use the code PODCAST at checkout, and you'll save a few bucks on whatever you buy.
Beautiful. Well, this episode of the American Hauntings podcast was written and narrated by Troy Taylor, and it was produced and edited by me, Cody Beck. To find out more about the show,
I should rewrite that so you get to say that's me, because I get to say that's me on two different podcasts. So I probably should do it so you could do it. Anyway,
I could go ahead.
I'll work on it.
Yeah, you check out the show notes or go to our website, AmericanHauntingsPodcast.com. If you want to find out more about the podcast, you can reach us via email, by text, the hotline, or Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, Threads, Blue Sky, and probably other places on social media that I don't remember right now or just don't care.
Yeah, I know. Social media is where the world goes to die.
It's too
civilization
much. It's too
goes
much.
To die, I guess. I don't know.
Thanks again for listening. We couldn't and definitely wouldn't do it without you. So until next time, goodbye.
So long.
See you later.
See you later.
All right. I actually hit the...
I wonder what happened. All the lights went out and then everything starts flashing. And I'm like, Jesus Christ, what is going on?
So the outlets in my room are very poorly positioned. So I basically have extension cords running.
Well,
and
yeah.
All you homeowners have unique needs. Some feel the need to leave up holiday decorations year-round. Others have the need to use their garage as practice space for their new metal band. And because each homeowner has unique needs, GEICO helps you get the right coverage for your home and what's in it. That way, you get exactly what's right for you, even if your needs are unique. Get more with GEICO.